Dreamforge Media presents
Cold Forge.
True Crime, Unforged Truth. April 10th, 1988. A Sunday morning. The York River Overlook sits on a gentle rise above the Colonial Parkway, maybe half a mile west of the Naval Weapons Station in Yorktown, Virginia. It's one of those scenic pull-offs the Park Service built so tourists could stop and watch the river. The wide tidal sweep of the York moving toward the Chesapeake, the tree line on the far bank still bare in early spring. In the early morning light, it's quiet, almost peaceful, the kind of place where you might sit on the hood of your car and listen to the water and forget that anything in the world is wrong. At approximately 7 o'clock that morning, someone noticed a red car parked at the overlook, a 1982 Toyota Celica. It wasn't unusual for cars to be there. People came to the parkway at all hours, for walks, for sunsets, for privacy. But by 9 o'clock, the car hadn't moved, and something about it felt wrong. The driver's side door was hanging open. The interior was visible from a distance. Someone called it in. When park rangers arrived, they found the car unlocked and unoccupied. The keys were sitting on the driver's seat. A gold wristwatch had been placed on the dashboard next to a pair of eyeglasses. In the back seat, nearly every piece of clothing the driver had been wearing, dress slacks, a polo shirt, a cardigan sweater, underwear, shoes, folded or laid out with what appeared to be deliberate care. Some of the passengers' clothing was there too. Her underwear among them, several empty beer cans, a purse but no wallet inside it, no blood, no signs of a struggle, no note, and no people. The York River Overlook is approximately 1 mile from the embankment where Kathy Thomas and Rebecca Dowski were found murdered in their car in October of 1986. 1 mile. The same stretch of road, the same quiet darkness, the same isolation that felt like privacy until it became something else entirely. Last week, we told you about David Nobling and Robin Edwards, found at Ragged Island in September of 1987. About the execution-style gunshots, about the truck with its doors open, about a 14-year-old girl who snuck out and never came home. This week, the pattern breaks, not because the violence stops, because the bodies disappear. This was the third time.
Richard Keith Call was 20 years old. Everyone called him Keith. He was born on March 8, 1968, and grew up in the Hampton Roads area of Virginia, that sprawling constellation of cities along the Chesapeake where military bases and shipyards anchor the economy and the water is never more than a few minutes away. Keith was a computer science major at Christopher Newport College, the small state school in Newport News that sat just off Warwick Boulevard, a commuter campus, practical and unpretentious. Keith was like the school in that way. He wasn't flashy. He was steady. His brother would later describe him as an old soul, shy at first, slow to open up, but once he did, warm and genuine and worth the wait, the kind of person who didn't perform friendship. He just offered it quietly, and you either noticed or you didn't. Keith loved the beach. He loved driving to it, and he loved the car that got him there. The red Toyota Celica was his pride, a 1982 model, angular and sporty in the way early 80s Japanese cars were, all sharp lines and pop-up headlights. His sister Joyce would later tell reporters that he was always washing it, always polishing it, every weekend. The car wasn't just transportation, it was proof that he was becoming someone. 20 years old, a college student, driving a car he took care of, because taking care of things was who he was. Keith had been in a serious relationship, nearly 4 years with the same girlfriend. They were on a break. 2 weeks into that break, Keith asked out a classmate, a girl he knew from campus, someone new, someone different. It was going to be a first date. Cassandra Lee Haley was 18 years old. Her family called her Sandy. She was a freshman at Christopher Newport, living with her family in Grafton, a small, quiet community just north of Yorktown, the kind of place where everyone knows which house belongs to which family, and the roads are named after people who've been there for generations. Sandy modeled. She taught gymnastics. She had the kind of energy that filled rooms without trying. Her mother, Joanne, would describe her the same way every time she was asked, for decades after. Sandy was generous, with her time, with her friendship, with her attention. There was nobody Sandy wasn't going to befriend. She was open in the way that 18-year-olds can be open before the world teaches them to be careful. Sandy had a curfew. Sandy was afraid of the water. Both of these details will matter.
The evening of Saturday, April 9th, 1988, began the way first dates do, with a plan and a little bit of nerves. Keith picked Sandy up at her family's home in Grafton in the Red Celica. They went to a movie. A Saturday night at the theatre, the most ordinary thing in the world when you're 20 and 18 and the semester is winding down and spring has finally come to Tidewater, Virginia. The dogwoods just starting to bloom, the air still cool enough for a cardigan, but warm enough to drive with the windows cracked. After the movie, they drove to a party at the University Square Apartments, a student housing complex just across the street from the Christopher Newport campus, the kind of place where weekend parties started after dark and ran until the early morning hours. Music through open windows, cars lining the parking lot, people drifting between apartments with cups in their hands. Keith and Sandy arrived together, but witnesses at the party would later tell investigators that the two spent most of the evening socializing separately. Keith talking to his friends, Sandy talking to hers. This wasn't unusual. They were classmates, not yet a couple, still in the early hours of figuring out what they might become. A first date at a house party means you don't sit in the corner together all night. You circulate, you check in, you find each other when it's time to leave. The last confirmed sighting places them leaving the party sometime around 1:30 in the morning on April 10th. Some accounts say as early as 11:30, others as late as 2:25. But the most consistent version of the timeline has them walking out together around 1:30, heading for Keith's car. Sandy had a curfew. They needed to get her back to Grafton. The drive from University Square to Grafton takes about 20 minutes if you go straight. You take Warwick Boulevard north to Interstate 64, then east toward the Yorktown exit. Direct, practical, the route a responsible person takes when there's a curfew to meet. But there's another way. You can take the Colonial Parkway. The parkway runs through the woods along the York River. At night it's dark, no streetlights, no commercial development, just the road and the trees and the water. Speed limit 25 miles per hour. Two lanes. The kind of road where headlights cut through nothing and the only sound is your engine and whatever's playing on the radio. The kind of road where a couple on a first date might stop at an overlook, where they might park and talk, or not talk, and watch the moonlight on the river and feel like the whole world has gotten very small and very private. We don't know whose idea it was to take the parkway. We don't know if they planned to stop or if the overlook just appeared and the moment felt right. We know almost nothing about what happened between 1:30 in the morning and 7 o'clock, when a passing motorist first noticed the Red Celica sitting at the York River overlook with its door open and no one inside. Keith Call and Cassandra Haley never made it back to Grafton.
The car was found at 7 in the morning, reported to authorities at 9. 2 hours passed while a red Toyota Celica sat at the York River overlook with its driver's door open and no one inside it. 2 hours during which other motorists passed, glanced, and kept driving. In those 2 hours, whatever had happened was already hours old. The parkway had already absorbed it. Let me walk through what was found. The keys were on the driver's seat, not in the ignition. On the seat, placed there. Keith's gold wristwatch was on the dashboard, his eyeglasses beside it, both positioned with what investigators would later describe as deliberate placement, not tossed, not dropped, but set down with intention. Nearly all of Keith's clothing was in the back seat. His brown and gray cardigan sweater, his white polo shirt, his two-tone brown dress slacks, his leather shoes, his underwear. Nearly everything he had been wearing when he left the party. Some of Sandy's clothing was there, too. Her underwear was in the back seat, her purse was in the car, her wallet was not. Several empty beer cans were scattered in the vehicle. No blood, no weapon, no torn fabric, no broken glass, no fingernail marks on the dash, no sign that anyone had fought back or tried to resist. The car was parked normally. It had not been rammed or pushed. The engine was off. The headlights were off. Everything about the vehicle suggested a voluntary stop. Two people who pulled over, parked, and at some point removed their clothing, and then were no longer there. Here is the question that investigators faced. Did two college students voluntarily undress at an overlook on a 40-degree April night, walk down a steep embankment in the dark, enter water cold enough to kill them in minutes and simply disappear? Both of them, at the same time, without leaving a single trace in the river? Or did someone make them do it?
This episode is brought to you by Synergy Digital Solutions. If your business is still running on manual follow-ups, scattered spreadsheets, and hoping the phone rings, it's time to upgrade. Synergy Digital Solutions builds AI-powered marketing automation systems that work around the clock for you. From automated lead follow-up and AI voice bots that call and qualify prospects, to SMS and email campaigns that run themselves, they handle the tech so you can focus on closing. And when it comes to getting found online, Synergy has you covered there too. They specialize in local SEO, that puts your business at the top of Google Maps and local search, plus web design that actually converts visitors into customers. AI automation, local SEO, web design, all under one roof. Visit synergydigital.io to learn more. That's synergydigital.io, and see how they can put your marketing on autopilot.
The park rangers called the National Park Service Police, who called the FBI. Within hours of the report, a team arrived at the York River Overlook with tracking dogs, bloodhounds trained to follow human scent over distance and terrain. The dogs picked up a trail immediately. It led south along the Colonial Parkway, away from the overlook, along the shoulder of the road. The handlers followed, as the dogs pulled forward with that singular focus that tracking dogs have when they've locked onto something real. The trail continued past the curve where the parkway bends toward the river, past the tree line, past the stretch of road that locals knew and tourists photographed. The dogs passed the exact site where Kathy Thomas and Rebecca Dowski had been found murdered in their car 17 months earlier. 17 months. 1 mile. The same road. Then the trail turned, off the road, down through the brush, toward the water. It ended at the shoreline of Indian Field Creek, a tidal inlet that feeds into the York River. The dogs circled the bank, worked the area, nosed the mud and the reeds and the waterline, and then stopped. The scent ended at the water's edge. The initial theory from park authorities was drowning. Two young people, probably intoxicated, had gone for a late-night swim and been pulled under by the current. It was a tidy explanation. It resolved the mystery without creating a larger one. But it fell apart almost immediately. The water temperature on the night of April 9th was approximately 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Early April on the York River. Not summer, not warm, the kind of cold that makes you gasp involuntarily when it hits your chest, that constricts your muscles and clouds your thinking within minutes. Hypothermia begins in water that cold before most people can swim 100 yards. The embankment at Indian Field Creek drops roughly 20 feet to the waterline. It's steep. It's overgrown with brush and root systems. It is not the kind of bank you scramble down casually in the dark, barefoot after a few beers on a first date. And Cassandra Haley was afraid of the water. Her family said it without hesitation, said it every time they were asked, said it to the FBI and the reporters and the documentary crews that would come over the years. Sandy did not swim. Sandy did not go near open water voluntarily, especially not at night. Especially not in April. Especially not in 40-degree river current at the bottom of a 20-foot drop in the dark. An extensive search of the York River was conducted over the following days and weeks. Divers went in, sonar scanned the river bottom, boats dragged the channel. The search expanded downstream into the Chesapeake Bay. They found nothing. No clothing, no personal effects, no remains, no evidence that two human bodies had ever entered that water. Keith Call and Cassandra Haley had simply vanished.
Let me tell you what the pattern looked like by April of 1988, October 1986. Kathy Thomas and Rebecca Dowski, their car found on the Colonial Parkway, pushed down an embankment, throats cut, no signs of struggle. The driver's seat adjusted for someone taller than Thomas. September 1987. David Knobling and Robin Edwards. Knobling's truck found at Ragged Island. Doors open. No signs of struggle. Both shot execution style. Edwards sexually assaulted. She was 14. March 1988. Lorianne Powell, 18. Last seen walking along Route 614 in Gloucester County. Found a month later in the James River near Ragged Island. Stabbed multiple times. Found nude. April 1988. Keith Call and Cassandra Haley. Car on the Colonial Parkway. No signs of struggle. Clothing removed. Clothing of both victims in the back seat. Bodies gone. Four incidents in 18 months. The same geography. The same tidal rivers. The same complete absence of defensive evidence. The same suggestion that the victims cooperated with whoever approached them, that they opened their doors or stepped out of their vehicles, or allowed someone close enough to take control before they understood what was happening. Each time, the victims were young. Each time, they were in isolated locations at night. Each time, the vehicle was left behind with personal belongings intact. Keys, wallets, clothing. As if the car didn't matter. As if the possessions didn't matter. Only the people mattered. Only taking them mattered. And now, for the first time, no bodies. The York River overlook was 1 mile from the Thomas Dowski site. 1 mile. The killer, if it was the same person, had come back to the same stretch of road. The same darkness. Almost the same pull-off. He was not hiding. He was not afraid of this place. It was his.
In the days immediately following the discovery of Keith Call's car, the FBI received a tip that would define the investigation for the next 3 decades. A local fisherman had been seen on the Colonial Parkway around the time of the disappearance. He was driving a blue 1966 Dodge Fargo pickup truck, an older vehicle, distinctive. Not the kind of truck you forget if you see it at 2 in the morning on a road where almost no one drives. According to at least one report, this fisherman had approached another couple parked on the parkway that same weekend. He had pulled up beside them. He had made them uncomfortable enough that they left. The fisherman's name was Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. Wilmer was a waterman, a term used in Tidewater, Virginia, for the men who made their living on the rivers and the bay, harvesting clams and oysters from their own boats. He worked out of the Northern Neck, the narrow peninsula between the Rappahannock and Potomac Rivers, on a vessel he called the Denny Wade. He knew these waterways the way other people know their neighborhoods, every creek, every inlet, every stretch of shoreline where the current moves and where it doesn't, every place where something dropped into the water would drift and where it would stay. He also ran a tree-cutting business. He was known in the area. He was not anonymous. The FBI placed Wilmer under surveillance, and almost immediately they observed something that sharpened their attention considerably. Wilmer was cleaning his truck, the blue Dodge Fargo. Not just washing it, he was spray-painting it, altering its appearance. You don't repaint your truck in the middle of April because it needs a fresh coat. You repaint your truck when someone has seen it somewhere you don't want to explain.
The FBI obtained a search warrant for Alan Wilmer's residence. Inside, they found handcuffs. They found a firearm. They found a man who lived near the water, who worked on the water, who had been seen on the Colonial Parkway at the time of the disappearance, who had approached at least one other couple that same weekend, and who was spray-painting his truck while investigators were still searching the York River for two missing college students. Wilmer also placed himself near the York River overlook, not through forensic evidence or surveillance photography, through his own words. He acknowledged being in the area around the time Keith and Sandy vanished, handcuffs, a gun, presence on the parkway, a truck being repainted, and an admission of proximity. The FBI administered a polygraph. We talked about this last episode, what a polygraph measures and what it cannot. The instrument reads involuntary physiological responses, heart rate, respiration, blood pressure, galvanic skin response. An examiner interprets those readings and makes a judgment about truthfulness. But the instrument has a blind spot the size of a personality disorder. A person who feels no guilt registers no stress. A person who can sit across from a federal agent and answer questions about two missing students with the same resting heart rate he has when he's pulling oyster cages, that person will pass. Not because he's innocent, because his body doesn't know the difference. Alan Wilmer passed the polygraph. The FBI released him. The surveillance ended. The pressure dissipated. Wilmer went back to his boats and his tree service and his life on the rivers of Virginia's Northern Neck. In May of 1988, the FBI offered a $10,000 reward for information about the disappearance of Keith Call and Cassandra Haley. By June, reporters covering the growing list of cases along the parkway began using a phrase that would follow them for the next four decades: the Colonial Parkway murders.
I want to stay with the absence for a moment, because the Call Haley case is different from every other case in this series, and the difference is the thing that makes it hardest to talk about. Kathy Thomas and Rebecca Dowski were found. Their families buried them. David Nobling and Robin Edwards were found. Autopsies were performed. Evidence was collected. 36 years later, DNA on Robin Edwards' body would identify her killer. The system failed them in life, but in death, the evidence was there, waiting. Keith Call and Cassandra Haley were not found. They have never been found. 38 years. Their families have spent 38 years without remains, without a burial, without the brutal but finite knowledge of how their children died. They have spent nearly four decades in the specific kind of limbo that only the families of the missing understand, where grief cannot fully begin because the story has no ending, where hope is both irrational and impossible to extinguish, where every phone call from an unknown number carries a weight that people who haven't lived it cannot begin to imagine. Joyce Call Canada, Keith's sister, has spoken publicly about what that absence does to a family. The not knowing. The way birthdays accumulate, Keith would be 58 now, and each one is a reminder not of loss, but of incompleteness. You didn't lose a person. You lost the possibility of knowing what happened to a person. And those are two different kinds of grief. and one of them has no flaw. Sandy Haley's mother, Joanne, has carried the same weight. For decades, her daughter left for a first date on a Saturday night and never came home. Joanne has never been given a reason, not an answer, not a body, not even a confirmed cause of death, just an empty car and a pair of bloodhound tracks that ended at the water. This is the particular cruelty of the Call Haley case, not just what was done to them, but what was taken afterward. The bodies, the evidence, the chance for the forensic work that, decades later, would link Alan Wilmer's DNA to five other victims. We know now that Wilmer was a serial killer. DNA has confirmed it. He killed Kathy Thomas. He killed Rebecca Dowski. He killed David Knobling. He killed Robin Edwards. He killed Lorianne Powell. He killed Teresa Howell. Six confirmed victims across 3 years. His DNA was on their bodies, their clothing, at their crime scenes. But Keith Call and Cassandra Haley, Wilmer was there that night. He was on the parkway. He was approaching couples. He was spray painting his truck. He had handcuffs and a gun in his home. He acknowledged being near the overlook. Every investigator who has worked this case believes Wilmer did it. But there are no bodies to test, no DNA to extract, no physical evidence to place in a lab and hold up in a courtroom or a press conference and say, "This man did this to these people." And so the case of Keith Call and Cassandra Haley remains, technically and officially, an open missing persons investigation. Not a murder, not a confirmed Colonial Parkway killing. Two students who left a party on a Saturday night in April of 1988 and were never seen again. Somewhere in the tidal waters of the York River or the Chesapeake Bay or wherever the current carried them. Keith and Sandy are still missing. The river took them. And the river has never given them back.
Next week, September 5th, 1989, Labor Day weekend, Daniel Lauer and Anna Maria Phelps. He was 21, she was 18. They were driving home to Virginia Beach from a visit with her family in Amherst County, a 3-hour trip down Route 29 to Interstate 64. They never arrived. Their car was found abandoned at a rest stop on I-64. But here's what didn't make sense. It was at the westbound rest stop. They should have been heading east, toward Virginia Beach, toward home. The car was parked facing the wrong direction. They were driving away from where they were supposed to be going. Months later, their bodies were found in the woods off a logging road, wrapped in a blanket. So decomposed that investigators could not determine a cause of death. Two more young people, another car with no one in it, another set of questions with no answers. Episode 5, Labor Day.
Cold Forge is produced by Stream Forge Media. Research and writing by the Cold Forge team. If you have information about the Colonial Parkway murders, the FBI Norfolk Field Office maintains an open tip line. Any detail, no matter how small, could be the one that matters. If this case moved you, share it with someone, leave a review, subscribe wherever you listen, and visit us at streamforge.media. We'll see you on the road.
Cold Forge. True crime. Unforged truth.